We're still working on major point six, happiness for the believer in time, which the believer can actually share in God's happiness, of course, whereas the unbeliever never can. The natural man not only doesn't accept the things of God, he doesn't experience them. And so happiness, whatever happiness he might have, again, is either derived from some principle of the truth that he might orient to, or some temporal thing that he's pursued that brings him happiness. So here we're dealing with, as it relates, sub-point M is the one we're on as it relates to the local church. As believers, point three, hear and apply the doctrine they are taught, they become the source of joy in time for the adjusted pastor. We looked at Philemon 1:7 there, now 3 John. This is one of those personal letters, 2 and 3 John. Were written apparently to individuals. 3 John 3 and 4. And of course, this is where he prays. This is the adjusted prayer for the adjusted pastor, that all those under their charge would be prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. Gaius there, who he loves in truth, but the soul has the idea that be in good health, and then you got akathos, exactly as, that there is a high correlation, a high degree of correlation between soul prosperity and physical prosperity. And again, the two things that you would tend to think of in physical prosperity is what he addresses, good health and prosperity, that you will be well. But again, to the extent that you are oriented to the truth. For I was very glad, verse 3, when the brothers came and testified to your truth. That is how you are walking in the truth. And so they didn't just testify, this guy has some doctrine, he's oriented. They testified as to his lifestyle. That his lifestyle was one that was visibly in line with the truth. That they could see it. And I have no greater joy than this. To hear of my children walking in the truth. And that's ultimately what we have to be all about as communicators, is getting the truth to people and hoping they orient to it, but knowing that in the end we can't do anything if they do or don't. It makes us happy when they do. Now, that's a part of your phase two prosperity as a pastor. Emotional happiness, spiritual happiness. So because people take the doctrine and actually apply it rather than looking for excuses why they can't, what's wrong this week, where are you, why can't you get oriented, what's going on. That kind of believer drives the pastor nuts, I can tell you from experience. So four, the adjusted communicator here recognizes the great value of unity in the local church. As the congregation unites in the divine viewpoint he teaches, his joy is increased. As you watch people orienting to God, Philippians, there, a passage we just kind of actually just looked at, Philippians 2:2. He talks about making his joy complete by being of the same mind, that the believers have the same love for one another, united in spirit, intent, thinking the one thing on one purpose. And so the reality is, as people orient to the truth, they come together. That which fragments and separates believers can't be the truth if they're wanting to orient to it. But obviously the truth does fragment people because the truth will set you free, but it doesn't set everybody free. That's the problem with it. But a lot of times the disunity and all of that comes as a result of the sin nature, demonic activity, selfishness and all of that. And that's, of course, what this whole entire chapter we just finished was all about. So five, therefore, the joy of the pastor and the joy of the congregation are contingent upon each other in some ways, as each one seeks to orient to God's plan in time. And we have to know the jury is out on all of us. Nobody has made it yet. Paul's going to be coming up to that in chapter 3 here. That I have not become perfect. I don't know everything about the Lord at this point. I haven't fully grasped all he is. 2 Corinthians Well, that doesn't look right. 124 is going to be... Oh, there it is. Okay. Here, as leadership, not that we lord it over your faith. We're not here to try to control you. That might be tempting at times as you watch believers who consistently seem to make bad decisions, who consistently seem to be out of step. You would like to see them straightened out, but your job isn't to straighten them out. You pray for them and all of that, but they ultimately have to make the decision, and they ultimately are going to pay the price for it one way or the other, either for good or for bad, in terms of being jammed or being blessed. And we want to see people blessed, prosper and be in good health, even as your soul prospers. If you don't have soul prosperity, none of it matters. I'd pray you never make a penny if your soul isn't prospering. You know, there's no point in getting ahead physically while you're spiritually decaying. There's no glory in that. But he says, not that we lord it over your faith, but we are workers with you for your joy. We want you ultimately to be happy and blessed. For in your faith, you are standing firm. And that's what we have to shoot for. Again, stand your ground. We saw it with the demonic attacks there in Ephesians 6. Stand. Three times or four times you're told to stand firm, to hold your ground spiritually, and don't let people push you around. They will try to. So in here, children are a part of the phase two happiness God provides. Psalm 127. This one's a real double-edged sword, however. We recognize that God designs, his design is for children to be a blessing. And they can be. But unfortunately, they can also go the other way. And then Solomon talks about this a lot in the book of Proverbs. He'll talk about the oriented child and the maladjusted child. The one who listens to his parents and the one who doesn't. The one who serves the Lord and the one who doesn't. That you have things that people can go various ways. And unfortunately, in the ministry and just in life, these are tests that you're going to face eventually. If you have kids, you face them. For children, beloved, behold, brother, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a quiver, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gates. But presupposed, I believe, underneath this isn't just that they are children, that they just have children, that they are adjusted children. Because they won't be ashamed indicates that their children are not doing anything to bring shame on them, shame on themselves. So if a child is oriented to God, that's a real blessing. The children that are not so much. It's discouraging. It's depressing. You see them wasting their life in this world. Oh, they may accomplish a lot of things in this world. They may grow up and be famous. Maybe Tom Brady. Maybe you'll win 7 Super Bowls. Maybe you'll cure cancer. Maybe you'll do whatever hasn't been done. Establish the first outpost on the moon as we go to look for intelligent life. Yeah, well, we know we need some. But the reality is, no matter what they accomplish, they're throwing their spiritual lives away. So what? So what if you win 7 Super Bowls? If Brady isn't a believer, can you imagine how hell's going to be for him? It's not going to be a picnic for anybody. But if you've really had it all, you've been at the top. You got the trophy wife, the model. You got all the kids are perfect. And you have this great career. And you do all these wonderful things. And you're lauded and praised and people carry on about you like there's nothing better than since sliced bread than you. And but then you die and lose it all. What has been gained? And this is what the problem with the cosmos is. They live out there in the darkness and they're throwing their lives away. You say, well, maybe they're accomplishing something good. Well, if you build a bridge, say, well, the bridge lives on after you. That's true. If it's built right. Some of them just fall down nowadays, apparently. You know, we've seen that happen. So the reality is children can be a double-edged sword. When they are oriented to the Lord, they are a great blessing. When they're not, they just leave you shaking your head sometimes as to what they're doing with their life, knowing that they're just wasting it day by day, week by week, month by month, pursuing their own agenda. Well, you can pursue your own agenda. God certainly is not going to stop you. That's a fact. But that agenda is going to lead to some painful lessons down the road and some painful results. Well, as with the relationship between the pastor and the congregation, the child that hears and applies doctrine becomes a source of great happiness to the parents that raised him. Proverbs 23. Proverbs 23, verses 24 and 25. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice. And he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your mother and your father be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. And of course, the command is, for this to happen, the child has to be committed to the same truth the parents are. This is one of the biggest mistakes parents have made throughout the ages that I've observed, even just in the time I've been alive on the planet. They don't force their children to live by the same principles of doctrine they live by. They allow children to do their own thing. And the child that's left to his own devices will ultimately probably bring you to shame, to sorrow, unfortunately. That's the reality of it. So give me your heart, my son. In other words, commit yourself to this. And let your eyes delight in my ways. Because this is a lifestyle that God has blessed. Solomon knows what he's talking about. We're here dealing with ostensibly the wisest man who ever lived. The most oriented. Now obviously Solomon had weaknesses and we all know what those were. But still, he understood these principles. And raising children was a part of his repertoire here that he insists on that parents do. Also here, chapter 27, verse 11. Be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may reply to him who reproaches me. And the idea is that the reproach would appear to become because of something in the son, that the son's behavior is bringing reproach on the family. But see, we don't have really much of an honor-shame culture anymore, frankly, to speak of. People are ashamed of what they ought to be proud of and proud of what they ought to be ashamed of. The cosmos is backwards. Everything is upside down. Black is white. White is black. Good is bad. Bad is good. Moral is immoral. Immorality is now moral. And that's the nature of the world. And so the idea is you want your child to live in a way that brings glory and brings honor and a good report rather than someone who's reproached or brings reproach on you, even worse. Proverbs, next one, 29:3. A man who loves wisdom makes his father glad. Well, obviously the counterpart to this is true too. The man who doesn't make his father glad. But he who keeps company with harlots wastes his wealth. So unfortunately, the opposite is also true. When a child rejects the principles of the truth, he becomes a source of pain and sorrow to his godly parents. The cosmos, now see, they don't care about this. As long as the kid is getting ahead in life, the cosmos just looks at it as a win. Well, I watched them. They were showing today, you know, some guy, I guess he was, signed his letter of intent with Florida. So he carried a gator into the press conference, live gator. Well, that's all impressive. But his mom, as she talked about, all she was worried about was that he'd go to college and get ahead in life. That was all she was worried about. Not if he's a wise person or grows up and has any kind of morality or Christianity or anything like that. Just that he get ahead in life. Because that's the be-all and end-all of life in America. Just get ahead. That's what it's all about. Well, the Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. That's just the way it goes. Unfortunately, we can't control them. That, like arrows, that's a good analogy, by the way. Because once you let that arrow go, you have no more control over it. And after they shoot off, as it were, out of the nest, out of the quiver, then they're on their own. And they have to then become their own person. And ultimately, of course, will answer to God for their behaviors, their decisions. Proverbs 15, 20 and 21. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. And you may think, well, there's no real hostility in a family setting. Oh, I would beg to differ. I would beg to differ. Jesus said very plainly, I did not come to bring peace. I came to bring a conflict. And that conflict's going to start in your household. And that's where it is, unfortunately. The negative wants to walk in darkness. They reject the light. That when they hear it, they see it, they walk away from it. The positive can't tolerate that. And can't encourage that. That's an acceptable way of life. So the foolish man despises his mother. He brings shame and grief to her. But folly is joy to the one who lacks sense. But a man of understanding walks straight. And this is what we have to teach our children. The spiritual understanding and walking before God in the straight and narrow is the be-all and end-all of life. Everything else is subservient to that. Anything that takes precedence over that is a wrong priority and should be addressed. But that's one of the challenges, is people have these advantages in life. And they believe that these advantages help them. But as Paul will also bring up in chapter 3, all the great advantages he had didn't accomplish a relationship with God for him. It didn't bring him blessing. He had all these great advantages. He had every advantage you would want. He was Jewish, for one thing. Salvation is of the Jews. The Jews are God's chosen people, there's no doubt. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. He was a full-blooded Jew. His parents didn't intermarry. They were both full-blooded Jews, probably both of the Pharisaic sect. That's how Paul was raised and brought up. He was the strictest segment of the Jews. We got a little profile. I didn't go into a great deal of detail because some of it's just historical, and history sometimes is not necessarily interesting, but understanding how these people got on the scene and what their mentality was, I think, is important. But Paul said, all my advantages didn't get me a relationship with God. The single most important thing in the world, a relationship with God. And all human advantages can't do anything about that at all, ever. Good ones and even the bad ones. So three here, the last point, the Greek term lupe, sorrow, denotes pain of mind, body, or spirit. It can involve distress, grief, pain, or sorrow. And so on parents, generally, the idea of this is more spiritual and emotional, certainly. Because when Jesus said, and it's all easy to read in the Bible, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring conflict. If you're going to follow me, you're going to create conflict with those around you. Just because you're following me and they're not. And that conflict is a part to show them that, number one, they're not oriented. We saw that recently there, I think back in Philippians 1, that the conflict and the pressures and the problems that come in all of this, when you see people on one side or the other. And so Paul, in verse 27, of course, encourages and promotes unity in the local body. Striving together with one another for the faith of the gospel, and in no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them. Well, we obviously don't want our children destroyed, but if they will not orient to God, there's not any way we can stop it. If they're going to blow God off, they're going to pay the price for that. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. So it's a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you. The fact that there is conflict with negative volition should tell you you're on the right side of this. That's what it should tell you. And that they are not, in fact, on the right side of this. So again, the pressures for the parent are, largely emotional, spiritual. By the time they get to be 18, you've raised them, the physical aspects are pretty much done. They're on their own person at that point. But ultimately, we'll stand before God just like we all will and face the judgment. All right, well, Roman numeral 7 here, happiness as it relates to eternity. A major factor in the eternal happiness of believer is found in the fact that the indwelling sin nature, which is the cause of sin and death, will be eradicated in the resurrection body. This is one of the first things that will make for a wildly different world. No sin natures out there rubbing against each other. No sin natures motivating people to certain behaviors and activities. Romans chapter 8, verse 29. Again, for those whom he foreknew, the golden chain here. He predestined to become conformed to the image of his son, so that he would be the firstborn among many brothers. And that image, of course, is a sinless image. And that is one of the things we have to look forward to. You haven't yet, I haven't yet, lived one day, one minute of experience apart from a sin nature. It's always there. It's always been there. And there's nothing we can do about eradicating it. But God will, ultimately. He's going to subject all things to himself. And that's going to involve the eradication of the sin nature. So there also, here 1 Corinthians 15. And all this mortal body, all the things we face. And in this case, Paul talks about the rapture. It's intriguing that Paul teaches about the rapture pretty clearly in a couple of places, like here's one of them. 1 Thessalonians 4 is another one. And yet Paul never one time says he's going to be raptured. Now here in this passage, when he says we will not all sleep, well, we are everybody who's alive right then. He has to include himself in the living. I mean, he can't say I'm dead. He can't write from the perspective of a dead man. What would a dead man write? He can't move the pencil. He wouldn't write anything. So I tell you a mystery. But Paul never talks about being raptured. In fact, he seems to not have a full read on what happens until the very end of his life. That during the course of his Christian life, he didn't know if he was going to be raptured or was going to be martyred or going to die of old age. He didn't know the future. And so we don't either. And that's the whole point. We don't know the future, but we do know that it's coming. I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. And all we in the context here also includes all church age believers. That is bigger than just Paul and those who are alive. I mean, obviously, you've got to write from the perspective of being alive. But in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised imperishable. And we will be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable. And this mortal must put on immortality. That which is perishable and mortal is subject to death and decay and all of those things. You are decaying day by day. As you're young, you're kind of on the way up, but that's all right. You'll hit the peak. And then you're going to be on the way down like the rest of us. That's just the way the world works. And so we will not longer be subject to that, to the decay of the body. Your eyesight won't get worse. Your teeth won't fall out. You won't have these problems, these aches and pains that become more pronounced as you get older. And this is why, again, you remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Bodily exercise is profitable now for a while. And this is the for while it's profitable. So that we can get around in this world. And be ready to make those decisions and those applications that are incumbent. So when this perishable shall have put on the imperishable, this mortal will have put on immortality. Then will come about the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin. And the power of sin is the law. And the reality is here, the sting of death actually comes from the sin nature, unfortunately. He uses a hamartia with the article here. As Paul was wont to do. And so the sin nature is going to be gone. There'll be no more death, no more sin, because it's going to be eradicated. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory. Who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. He is our salvation. He is our everything. He is our sufficiency. He is our righteousness. He is our joy. He is our peace. He is the Savior. He is the Redeemer. He is your brother. He is your friend. He occupies a lot of things in God's plan. This is why his reputation is so great. He has all of these qualities and more. I mean, I've just touched on a few of them. So a secondary factor in the blessings of eternity is that the enemies of the truth, both human and angelic, have been eliminated. Isaiah chapter 14. This gets into that section. It begins to be addressed. I believe the prophecy takes a dual format here. He takes up a taunt in verse 4 against the king of Babylon. And now here, this is a nation, as we know, that has been militarily devastated, completely eradicated. And then there's the command to take up the taunt over him. It's not bad enough. This is kicking him when he's down. But this is how God, this is how evil God thinks a lot of this stuff is. Take this taunt up over him. How the oppressor has ceased. And then you get into this matter in verse 9. Sheol from beneath is excited to meet you when you come. Oh, can you imagine the U.S. president who's done whatever he wanted to for most of his career? And has made decisions that have adversely impacted millions and maybe sometimes billions of people. Harmed them. Bad decisions based, economic decisions, because we are in bed with the kings of the earth. And the military leaders and all. So they all say, look at you, now you're as weak as we are. You've become like us. Well, that doesn't sound like fun. You get to hell and then you're taunted on top of it? That's a bad deal there. So then in verse 12, obviously, the language goes far beyond the king of Babylon, however. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, O son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth. And I presume this star of the morning, son of the dawn, has some reference to, again, the question is, were the angels created all at once? Were they created in segments? Were they created one at a time? We know there's lots and lots of them. We don't even know how many there are. We know a third of them have fallen. But Satan appears this idea of son of the dawn would suggest he was there from the earliest time. That he was there in the beginning. But you have said, you have been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? And all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword. And so again, I think the language here goes far beyond just a human leader. It applies to both, but addresses Satan, the ruler behind the scenes that promoted all of this and promoted the king of Babylon, obviously. He's in favor of this. God's against it, so Satan's in favor of it. We know that. So there, and then also the fulfillment, Revelation 20, 15. And this, of course, is the final resurrection. The resurrection of unbelievers. It begins back before this, back in about verse 10, I think, or 11. I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it. But death and Hades, verse 14, were thrown into the lake of fire. That is the second death. That is the final death. That is an eternal death. That is a death that never stops. It is not eradication. It does not involve the destruction of the soul. They become non-existent. You think, well, eventually they'll die and they'll never be conscious of anything. No, this is conscious, eternal torment forever. That's what the second fire, the second death is all about. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Well, for one thing, obviously, I'm very happy just about not going there. The salvation at least delivered me from the lake of fire. Very happy about that. And so, obviously, the goal would be to live a life that reflects that thankfulness, that gratitude, and all that. So, at the marriage supper of the Lamb, okay, is also portrayed as a blessed and happy event. Now, we recognize that a whole lot of really bad stuff is going to happen before we get there. But we recognize that ultimately, in the end, God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's something we pray for. Here, Matthew chapter 22, he spoke to them in parables, saying the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. And you can imagine, of course, and have a family, and the father's proud of his son. He's grown up, become quite a young man, and so he wants to give him the very best here. And he sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, but they were unwilling to come. And so there's some judgment here in all of this, I understand, because of the negative volition. And this speaks to the negative volition of the Jews. They were the first ones invited. To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. That was Paul's dictum, that was Jesus' dictum, and that's the dictum we would use. The Jews had first shot at all of this. And they were unwilling to come. And so it's a blessed and happy event. Everybody dresses up. And you understand what a great event is like. Everybody puts on their best. They go out. They show off their new hats and shoes or sandals in this case, I guess. And come out to the wedding hall. And it's all, and it's glorious. It's going to be glorious. The guy's going to throw a party, a great shindig there. And this is just in parabolic form. I mean, he doesn't address it all. And then Revelation 19, Revelation is the fulfillment of it here. And it doesn't get, you know, much press. But if you understand the Old Testament prophecies, especially with regard to the Messianic kingdom and the nature of that kingdom, here, that doesn't look like the right one. Where are we at? 7:19. Oh, 7 through 9. Huh? I was going to say, come assemble for the great supper of God. That's, yeah, well, there's going to be one, but it's not like what they think. Then I heard something like the sound, the voice of a great multitude, and like the sound of many waters, and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder, saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord our God, the Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to Him. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and His bride has made herself ready. It was given her to her to clothe herself in fine linen. That even in this aspect of it, when the church is presented in all its glory, it's given to her. It's a grace from God that brings all this about and makes it possible. She was clothed herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And then he said to me, Write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, These are the true words of God. But that's all that's said about it. And in reality, at the end of the book of Revelation, we don't get much on the millennium at all. There's a few verses, says it's going to be 1,000 years, and that's it. And most of the book of Revelation is devoted to Daniel's 70th week and the destruction that has to occur before all these great blessings come into being or are made manifest. They're in existence now. Well, the millennium is also described as a time of incomparable peace and joy on the earth. Isaiah 14:7. Again, there seemed to be a transition from the direct prophecies of Babylon in Isaiah 14 there, to the forces behind the scenes as well. The satanic force behind the scenes. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. Has that ever happened once in your experience? No. None of us have ever seen this. This has not happened. From the beginning, after Adam and Eve fell, and again, I don't suggest that they were long in that garden. I think it could be measured in weeks or months. I don't think they weren't in the garden for years. They certainly weren't there for decades. There's too much proof that this all happened pretty quick. And also, that why would Satan want them to get in there and get comfortable and get settled in? It would be much better to attack them right out of the chute. And if I'm smart enough to figure that out, I think the devil is. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. There's going to be no more. The United Nations, in their great wisdom, as they try to appropriate the verses of the Bible to themselves. So you have Isaiah out there in front of the United Nations that man's not going to learn war anymore. Well, under the UN, that's all we've learned. It's a joke. It's another one of those backwards things. United Nations here to save the world. No, they're here to destroy the world. They want a global government, and we don't. We believe in nationalism. They don't. They're internationalists. And not only, of course, do we support all this, we pay for it, to boot, with our American tax dollars. So the whole earth is quiet. This is what we look forward to. Also, chapter 35, a little more detail. As it describes the conditions of a planet, that much of which now, in certain cases, is becoming a wilderness. And we recognize that. I mean, you can see the stuff out there with Lake Mead, what's happening if you've looked at it. It's becoming a wilderness. People are burning up, not literally from the fire, but from the heat as well. And it's going to affect crops. It's already affected cattle, meat prices, and that kind of stuff. It's almost like our country can't catch a break from God. Now, why is that, you wonder? Why would God be so down on us? But people don't want to stop and ask these questions and figure out, well, we better get back to the scriptures. Well, the wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Arabah, that's the dry region down there in the southwest, will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. And sometimes it's just spoken of in terms of the physical realities, and sometimes it's personified, the creation. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those with an anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with a vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. The eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Will there be any actual physical maladies during the millennium? I don't know. It sounds like there won't be. That this will be taken care of. And can you imagine that? If there were no, I know I can't say it, handicaps. If there were, you know, but you use handicap if you're in a handicapped spot. But you can't call somebody handicapped. But there are handicaps. Handicaps are things that make it harder. That's all they are. It's not a moral issue. Your eyesight's not a moral issue. Your hearing, not a moral issue. Your brain, moral issue. But not the other stuff. So again, will they have perfect health throughout all this? It says, again, that if you live to be less than 100, they're going to think you're cursed. So will everybody enjoy absolute health and all of this and live in a world with no external war and no internal problems? As Jesus rules from Jerusalem, the rod of iron is going to guarantee there's no criminal activity. And they live in this environment for 1,000 years and still don't believe in the one who sits there and provides it. That is the nature of negative volition. Even when they see, they won't believe. That's why we're told, blessed are those who did not see and yet believe. The ears of the deaf will be unstopped and the lame will leap like a deer. And so does that mean, okay, if I've had some sort of physical problems? Or are they just not born with these kinds of things? Maybe no more motorcycle wrecks. I don't know if they'll have motorcycles. Who knows? And the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. For waters will break forth in the wilderness. The scorched land will become a pool. And thirsty ground springs of water. And the haunt of jackals its resting place. Grass becomes reeds and rushes. A highway will be there. A roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. And the unclean will not travel on it. But it will be for him who walks that way, and fools will not wander in it. No lion will be there. Nor will any vicious beast go up on it. And there's other passages that suggest beasts will lose their ferocity. That snakes, you know, the black mamba won't kill you. You know, it will now. I guarantee you, there's a lot of snakes out there that'll kill you. But the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, with everlasting joy on their heads. And they will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. And sometimes that's it. You may not be overly sorrowful, but sometimes you find yourself just deep sigh that you've had enough. Also, Isaiah 51. Three and 11. Similar ideas here. The Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. And her wilderness He will make like Eden. So, picture. I mean, all we can do is think about it and picture it. What would the Garden of Eden look like? Well, first, it had every kind of plant, and they were beautiful. And they were arranged well. God didn't just throw the whole thing together. He packed here some seeds and throw them out, and what you have is what you have. He didn't do it that way. And Adam was to take care of it and keep it looking nice. Of course, it's a symbol of perfection. And the wilderness He will make like Eden. And not only will we be restored, the planet and all of that, but it'll have something Eden didn't have, and that is the ability not to fall. That it's not going to happen again. That they can't lose it. And the desert, like the garden of the Lord, joy and gladness will be found in her. Thanksgiving and the sound of a melody. And also verse 11, so the ransomed of the Lord will return and will come with joyful shouting to Zion. And everlasting joy will be on their heads. They will obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So the eternal state, of course, is described as lacking in any sort of death, mourning, crying, or pain. Therefore, it is logical to conclude that the believer in eternity will experience the happiness for which he has capacity. Now, I do believe, obviously, that when you get into the eternal state and the resurrection, you have this matter of what they had in their souls before they got there. Because that's the only thing we can take when we die or are raptured is what we've got in our souls, the new man, the human spirit, our doctrine. And those who have a lot of doctrine are going to have more capacity for what all this is and will have greater enjoyment in it, probably, than those who don't. Now, it's not to say they won't enjoy it, but they will enjoy it to the level at which they can. They won't necessarily enjoy it in the same. You can see the same thing today. You take two people. Two people, take them to a baseball game. One who's never seen baseball before and doesn't know what it is. And one who's watched it all his life, knows all the things about it, understands the game inside and out. Which one is going to enjoy the game more? And I guarantee you it'll be the one with the most experience. The one who understands it. Because he'll know when a good play was made. The person watching the game for the first time may say, oh, well, that was cool. And, you know, but did they really have capacity for what was happening there? If you manage to, and there's not been very many of them in the course of Major League history, but if you happen to sit through a perfect game where a pitcher, no runner gets to first base, no walks, no hits, no nothing. They can all be ground outs, fly outs, whatever it is, strikeouts. But a perfect game. Well, that's astonishing that you could do that even. It's so rare. But if a person who'd never seen baseball saw a perfect game, they might think, well, that was just boring. Nothing happened. I mean, we were at a Rays game once when it was one of those games where it was just a tight game, well played. It was, I think the Rays were up 1-0, went into the ninth, and then the Rays gave up a run and they tied it. And then it went into extra innings. Those who like baseball, extra innings is great. It's free ball. You only paid for 9 innings. I mean, now you get 10 or 11 or 12. Now you really don't want those 26-inning games. You wouldn't want to be around for that. Nowadays, they don't even finish them. They just break them off and come back. But if you're there and you see all that, and then the Rays score an exciting play, the bottom of the 10th, they score the winning run, and the crowd goes wild. But that people had capacity for what they were seeing, and they got it. And people in heaven will too. So Revelation 21:4, and he will wipe every tear away from their eyes. And there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. So all the disappointments we faced, all the problems, all the pressures, all the tests, this is all going to be made right. We enter into our rest. And it's designed to be a happy place. It's not just we're up there resting, you know, not doing anything with a corona or something, you know, on the beach. But everybody's happy. Everybody's joyful. This is what God's plan's all about. But people don't want to suffer in the here and now. They don't want to hear that. They want it all to be fun and games all the time. But it's not. That's not God's plan. So again, the believer will be there and he'll have whatever he has capacity for. No doubt he will enjoy. So faith in the reality of phase three happiness, that is the recognition of coming rewards, was what motivated the great believers of the past to endure in time. Their focus, Hebrews, was on that which is coming, not on what they were enduring at the time. And they all went through different kinds of tests, as we know. Hebrews 11:10. And I believe this is Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, went out, not knowing where he was going. He walked by faith. Even when he left Ur, where am I going? I don't know. God said, I'll show you. And so he believed God, and it was imputed to him as righteousness. And so that's what righteousness is, believing God. That's where our faith lies. So verse 10, why? He lived as an alien in the land of promise. Did you know that in the land of Canaan that was promised to Abraham back there and confirmed about the time he was 100 with the heir, that was promised to him that he never owned one square foot of that land? Never had any of it for himself. Still hasn't. The only land he owns in Canaan was a burial plot for Sarah. That's all we got's a grave there. That's all Abraham ever had. And he never saw this promise. He never experienced it. He never participated in being in the land. By faith, he lived like an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, who were fellow heirs of the same promise. Why? He lives in a tent because he's looking for a city. He's looking for something that's much more firm and stable. Something that has foundations, as he says here. A city is much more permanent than a tent, no doubt. And he's looking for the eternal city. He's looking for the New Jerusalem, is what he's looking for. Now, he may not have known that at that time. Because at first, Jerusalem was just called Salem during his lifetime. But did he know that was going to be the place where God established his name? I don't know that Abraham was ever told that. I don't think he had that knowledge. So he's looking for this, a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. It's a permanent place. And that's where he wants to live. Also, verses 14 and 15. For those who say such things. Now, this is the people who died without receiving the promises. All of these died in faith in verse 13 without receiving the promise. And by the way, they still haven't got those promises. They will not get the full benefit of that package until after the rapture, until we actually get our blessings before they do. That's a part of God's plan for the church age, the primacy of the church in that new regime. Not that Israel will not be there. They will, obviously. But having seen these promises and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that... they were oriented to what their time on this planet's about. They're not here to make a name for themselves, a history, a legacy, all of the stuff people are into. They recognize we're just here as aliens and strangers. This isn't our home. For those who say such things, verse 14, make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And then also, verses 24 and 26. dealing with Moses here. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He repudiated everything that he had and had been offered in one of the greatest dynasties of Egypt. That they were either still at the very tail end of the 18th dynasty or had just come out of it. But it was a high point in Egyptian history. And so Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And the passing pleasures that sin has, again, a certain fun to it sometimes. If sins weren't ever fun, people wouldn't do them. I mean, if sinning made you miserable, you'd quit doing it. But the problem is it appeals to the flesh, and that hook is always there for us. So considering here the reproach of Christ, greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. His focus was on those phase three blessings that we know are coming, but we haven't seen. But that the whole system, Satan, the world system, all of it's designed to get us to doubt it and not believe it. And to believe that they have the straight of it. Well, they don't. So again, this matter of suffering for Christ and with Christ. We're going to get more of that coming up. Because that is, essentially, that is our Christian life. We are identified with him, and as he goes, so we go. That's just the nature of it. Well, the same promise of phase three happiness motivated Jesus Christ to endure his unique sufferings. Next chapter there, 12:2. Fixing our eyes on Jesus. Again, not on our circumstances, not on the things that are around us, not on our own failures, all the things that can distract you. But occupation with Christ is the key element that's going to ensure success in your Christian life. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him as he looked towards the future, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And consider him who's endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you don't grow weary and lose heart. That's our challenge. The longer you run this race, the more prone you are to soul feigning. The worse it can get if you don't stay on top of it. And again, this gets into staying on top of it. Just being in the moment. Okay, Lord, what do you want now? What now? What next? What? Okay. And I want to do that. And it may not always be glorious or noteworthy or anything else, but it may be God's will for you in that moment. Well, that's what we want to do. So he looked to the future in his humanity and recognized that I've got great glory coming out of this if I apply in the here and now. But the here and now meant spiritual death for him and ultimately physical. So similarly, that same knowledge of coming joy is available to the believer in time, which should serve as a motivation to complete one's course before the Lord. The book of Jude, the one right before Revelation, Jude, here, 24. Now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling, he can save you from that fall that will destroy you. You may stumble from time to time. This isn't a promise, by the way, he'll never let you stumble. But he's got the power to keep us from it, and certainly to stand in the presence of his glory, blameless, with great joy. Again, this is a part of a doxology, praising God for the fact that he's doing all this and will do it. We'll complete his work until the day of Christ, as we know. All right, well, that's a good place to stop. We'll stop there today and pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in these things. We pray that we would indeed have the joy of the Lord as our strength as we live the Christian life, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.